Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. All right, we are on paper 47, section 3, which is old single column, page 532. All right, so we did the introductory part of this paper last session, where they gave us a little bit more on the Finaliter's world. Remember, you've got seven primary satellites around Gerasim. The Finaliter's world is the first of those seven primary satellites. And they also talked about the probationary nursery, which takes up, remember, half of that, of the Finaliter's world. Now we're ready for the seven sub-satellites that are around the Finaliter's world, the so-called mansion worlds. So that's the main body of this paper, obviously by the title of the paper. And they're just going to step us through them one at a time. So, there's really no preface than just that. We're going to, as we go through the sequence, you'll see they try to encourage us to recognize the seven of them as a sequence. They can give us some hints about what kind of a sequence, what kind of a logical succession there is going on here. And we want to challenge ourselves to see if we can recognize that as much as possible. Anything beyond what they immediately state about what that first overarching process is ahead of us as we head off our nativity sphere here. And unlike those children under roughly age 16 that we were talking about last week that were needing to go to the probationary nursery first, we'll all be headed to the first mansion world. This is where we go next. So it's always fun to see what you can glean out of this, the curiosity we have about what's life like after we die here. So let's jump in.
Number 3, the first mansion world. On the mansion worlds, the resurrected mortal survivors resume their lives just where they left off when overtaken by death. When you go from Urantia to the first mansion world, you will notice considerable change, that if you had come from a more normal and progressive sphere of time, you would hardly notice the difference except for the fact that you were in possession of a different body. The tabernacle of flesh and blood has been left behind on the world of nativity.
Okay, now, if it's not obvious that comment that they're making about that we will notice a considerable change. You can see from what they say, the quote-unquote considerable change is maybe not immediately what you think of, based upon, as we've talked about, life on these first Morantia worlds. The fact that you will have a Morantia body, well, that's pretty different, isn't it? And you'll be using Morantia mind instead of Adjutant mind, and all these various things. There'll be all these beings that you'll be able to see that you can't see right now. But you notice that's not what they're pointing to. I mean, all that's true of someone on a more normal and progressive sphere. Right? The big issue is, we have such limited ability to supply favorable conditions to have our soul grown in this life, that we have a very, all of us are going to have quite an embryonic soul, that's what's actually resurrected there. So, there's going to be a fair amount of discontinuity. There's an awful lot of the life that we're living right now that is not of a cosmic enough nature that it's getting copied into that soul. A lot of the life we're living right now is really not our lives. It's we're a means for the evolution of the Supreme. An awful lot of our life here is the Supreme evolving into existence, not us as an individual evolving into existence. And so, you know, you're going to wake up with a significant, at least immediate, disconnect in terms of what memories you have, in many ways, in a relative sense, there'll be a disconnect in the sophistication of your consciousness. You'll very much have to get your sea legs there. Right now, what's very kind of familiar with your surroundings and, is kind of chug along without thinking about it too much in your day-to-day life, is that animal origin creature that's not really the real you. It's not the you that is separating itself from the Supreme. It's the drop of water in the ocean of the Supreme part of you, right? And you leave all that behind, right? So, when they talk about the spirit-fused mortals, who of course don't have any memory because they don't have their adjuster, they're fusing with a spirit fragment of the Creative Mother Spirit, so they don't have any memories when they wake up, and they have to acquire all of their, reacquire memories from that nativity sphere life by looking it up in the records. I mean, we're going to have to do that quite a bit too. They don't focus on that, but just notice if you think about what they're saying in this very first paragraph, that's between the lines. That's just a gentle reminder. Don't expect to, when they say, that you pick up, resume their lives just where they left off, no, not in an animal origin sense, right? In a real you sense. The real you picks up right where it left off.
Can you speak to that a little bit more? If you're old and senile, that doesn't matter.
Right, because, right now, I'm thinking with my adjutant mindal self. I'm thinking, talking to you with my adjutant mindal self. That self is not resurrected. What's resurrected is that other self that's also present here with me, my Marantia self. That Marantia structure, that soul, is a Marantia brain. It has a Marantia mind energy system engaged down to it. There is a mindal self there that's conscious, that's thinking, that's making decisions. That's the real you. And that's what is resurrected. That's what will wake up, as if it just closed its eyes and opened its eyes again. And not skip a beat. It'll pick up right with the same train of thought that it had when when you died. But your adjutant you, that's different, right? There's a whole bunch of things that just come to an end. This self that's talking right now is a mortal self. Period. It just comes to an end. No mortal self is resurrected. The only thing that's resurrected is the potentially immortal self. That Marantia self, that other self. Right now there are three selves that are coordinated together. There's your mortal self that you're that within which part of that mindal self domain is conscious, and that's what you're conscious with right now. There's that Marantia self, and there's the adjuster self. There's three selves. All three have, all three are mindal selves, all three are thinking, making decisions. And a little bit, the self that you're conscious of right now, has, because it has personality identified with it, it's also making some choices. But those other two selves can't make choices. They're not personalized selves. Neither the adjuster self nor that Marantia self. Same way with those children on the mansion world. Once they get to roughly age 6, they all get adjusters. They've got a Marantia self. That Marantia self doesn't have personality identified with it because it's the material self that has personality identified to it. Yes, their Marantia self is separate from the Marantia selves of their parent or parents that are on the first mansion world, but their personalized mind or self is not separated yet. You know, until roughly age 16. That's why they're on the probationary nursery. They're still mindily attached to their parents. You know, in what is, despite the fact that you think, well, isn't Marantia greater than Adjutant? Yes, but which one is personalized? Which one is really greater? Which one has an actual connection to eternity going on? You know, that's the profound thing. Your Marantia self doesn't have a connection to eternity right now, like this clumsy animal origin Adjutant self that you're thinking with right now does. You know, the last shall be first, and, you know, in some ways, see? So,
is there a way to recognize this at all in your own?
And, you know, like they explain in paper 111 about the adjusters and the soul, you know, don't expect to have any awareness of this other self during this life. I mean, you know, like they tell you, you know, you can't even expect to have any remote direct awareness of the adjuster, and you'll have awareness of the adjuster before you'll have an awareness of your Marantia self, because that Marantia self is a super additive consequence of the relationship between the adjuster self and your mortal self, right? So it's higher. Now, it's more difficult to get to have any awareness of. So, you know, think of what the Revelation is saying about trust. You have to trust that your adjuster, in a completely unconscious part of your mind, is taking care of all the details as you would like it to take care of the details, so that you wake up on the first mansion world. You can't check. Make sure that other self, okay, yeah, that's me. I'll be okay if I'm, you know, going to be that self in the next life and not this one that's conscious right now. You know, you've got to trust. Remember how it says, trust everything beyond the dead level of consciousness. You know, in that vast mindful self you have, just a tiny measure of it is a conscious space. Most of it is that of your mindful self. Most of your decisions, most of your choices, most of your experiences are unconscious experiences and choices. Right? Not something that humans have ever thought. Right? We've always thought that our consciousness defines the boundaries of ourself. Not even close. Right? You know, when you think of it in the vertical cylinder analogy, you know, that your conscious self is a thin little layer in that vertical cylinder. And there's this great, big, huge domain below that thin little conscious layer that's an unconscious domain. That's your subconsciousness. And there's a great, big, huge region above that thin little layer that's also an unconscious domain. That's your superconsciousness, right? You know, the proportions are not even close, you know? You know, they literally want you, you know, they use language so that you picture it in that analogy as a thin little layer. Most of your mindful self, you know, this is not the whole mind energy system we're talking about. This is all yourself inside of this cylinder analogy. And most of it's unconscious. And, you know, and way up in the upper reaches of that unconscious domain, there's a soul and a Marantia self, you know, that's also in that column that's part of you. It's that upward reflection of you. It's the real, potentially real you. You know, that can go on.
So what can you expect to get out of this life? That may be a blasphemous question.
No, it's not. It's an extreme, one of the most important things that the fifth epical revelation has to offer us is, you know, humans have always struggled with, I don't think most of the things that are going on in my life, and the more Chris explains what about this, the more so I think this, I don't think most of the things in my life have any meaning. And the revelation doesn't say, oh, no, they have meaning. No, it tells you, yeah, you're correct. They have no meaning. Most of what you do in your life has no meaning for you as an individual. It only has meaning for the Supreme. You got to remember, it's not just you that's evolving here.
What have you done for me?
right? I mean, if it's sad to record that I'm using very, very little of my personal nature, that means most of me is very little separated from the ocean of the Supreme. Most of my life is part of the evolution of the Supreme and has no meaning for me whatsoever. Not just a little bit, none, zero, zero meaning for me.
And yet you have to experience it.
You have to recognize your duty to the Supreme. You have a moral duty. You have a duty to the cosmos. And you have a duty to the Supreme. And the Supreme is not just the Mother. Right? You have a duty to the universal harmony. You have a duty to the Mother. But the Supreme is the superadditive consequence of the relationship between the Almighty and the Mother. You know, gives the Supreme. What about the other half of the picture? You have in saying that you have a duty to the cosmos, a duty to the Supreme, means you have a big chunk of duty to the Almighty. That summation phenomenon of the total finite. You have a duty to live your life to the best of your abilities so that the Supreme can evolve through you. You're a lump of the Supreme. Mostly. As we go through the mansion worlds, we begin to coalesce out of the Supreme, and more of what we do in each of those seven lives has meaning to us as an individual. But in this first nativity life, an awful lot, especially because we didn't get the biologic uplift and stuff that we, that just means all the more that there's a lot of the Supreme evolving through what's going on here, and not individual meaning yet. It has value and meaning, but not to you as an individual. It only has value and meaning to the Supreme. So it doesn't have survival value, that term that they use. There's a whole bunch of stuff you do that has value, but it has no survival value.
And yet, you said earlier, and the last while I wasn't here, but that you have to experience that in order to be a finaliter. You don't experience
right. There has to be all these experiences because the Supreme is what kind of deity? Existential deity? No. Experiential deity. It's fundamentally an experiential fact. It comes into existence via experiences. That's what you think, well, what about all these experiences that I'm not conscious of? Shouldn't I be conscious of those? They're my experiences, aren't they? No. Mostly no. They're part of the Supreme. You have to open yourself up to be a means to the Supreme's end. You have a duty to live your life well, not merely for yourself. Can you be that selfless that a majority of your life here is not something that you're going to take with you because it's not your life, really. It's the Supreme's life. It's the Supreme's evolution. The Supreme can't evolve unto itself. It evolves through all of the things and beings in the finite. At least the Almighty part does, right? That Almighty part, none of that comes of itself. All of that they call it the summation, right? It's the summation of all of the things and beings that are happening in the finite domain. The part of the Supreme that isn't like that is the Mother. That's the downwelling part, the part that was there before the beginning. But the Almighty is, at the beginning is zero, and it begins to accumulate. Right? Yep.
There's a disconnect mm-hmm. in my mind with what you're saying, and it's. I'll try to express what it is. It's if the Almighty's evolving mm-hmm. with or without me.
Yeah.
Okay. Meaning if I just live my life for myself, irregardless of universal harmony or whatever, you're saying that's of use to the Supreme. And if it's of little use to me.
Right, I mean, the supreme mind, you know, that encompasses the finite, can take any set of finite facts and do something positive with them. So if you don't, you know, actively consecrate yourself, you know, to this duty that you have, you know, we're used in spite of ourselves, right? I mean, if you exist, you're being used as a conduit for the evolution of the Supreme. The only way that you can get out of that is to go to iniquity and make yourself non-existent. If you exist, the Supreme is using you as a means to his end, right? As a means for his evolution. Right? But when I say, you know, the revelation is here to inform us the way we've never been informed before of this duty. Because, good news, we are actually beginning to be a personal enough phenomenon that we can, through choice, participate significantly in this process. And, you know, when you are given that liberty, with every measure of liberty that you're given, that personality liberty, comes a responsibility. You're being informed of what that responsibility is for the first time in human history. Because for the first time, it's potentially significant. What we can do in our initial, you know, small personal way, you know, is sort of out of the noise now. And we need to know that. You now have to recognize the duty that comes with that gift. That gift of exercising personality. You know, there's a lot of duties that you have because you're a person, and that's one of them that humans have never appreciated. You have a duty to the Supreme. That's what moral duty is. It's a duty to the cosmos. You know, it's not a duty to your moray system. We finally know what the definition of the word moral is for the first time in human history. It's a duty to the cosmos. It's a duty to experiential deity. It's a duty to the Supreme.
Jesus kind of said that to his apostles in a way.
Yeah. You know. Right. And predicated on taking a hold of that duty, a duty to the Almighty and a duty to Mother, it's sort of a twofold duty, this moral duty, this duty to the cosmos. Because what is, you know, cosmos has two meanings, correct? Intensively. It's the universal harmony. Well, that's your duty to the Mother. It also means the harmonizing universe. That's your duty to the Almighty. Right? Cosmos is fundamentally twofold. Okay, so, but built upon consecrating yourself to that duty, assuming that duty, you then have a duty to others. You have an ethical duty. Now, that's the difference between moral and ethical. Moral is a duty to the cosmos. Ethical is a duty to others. And then, amongst all those others, there's the other. You have a duty to the other. You have a religious duty. You have a duty to God. Right? But it all is predicated on that initial foundational duty of a duty to the cosmos, a moral duty. You won't manifest the proper, ethical behavior or religious behavior until you predicate those upon that moral consecration, that consecration to the whole and the individuality of the whole. So, all right. So anyway, we got a little bit off field, this is what it all comes to. You know, is what's between the lines. There is recognizing that, we need to work on not having such a self-centered worldview. Too much fixation on God the Father produces a too self-centric worldview. You know, everything gets rationalized that it's all about you in some way or another. Well, that leads to a lot of problems. If you think that, you know, your whole life is all about you, and so, you know, then when bad things happen to you, you're going, well, what's, you know, what did I do wrong? Why do bad things happen to good people? You know, and all this sort of stuff. It's like, well, it's not about you, okay? You know, stop assuming it's about you and you won't have this conundrum. Right? It's just part of a completely inscrutable process that only has recognizable meaning to a being who can encompass the entire finite. None of the revelators can see any meaning in these things in your life either. Their minds are not big enough. None of them can encompass the entire finite in their consciousness. You know, so they shrug their shoulders about this stuff too. Right? It's only scrutable in the context of the whole. You know, the master architects can see it, you know, because they're bigger than the supreme being.
Master sons.
Right? Master sons. No. I mean, even a master son, the only concept of the supreme that he now encompasses is local universe-sized footprint of the supreme.
Pretty good.
It's, you know, it's big relative to us. Pretty small, though, relative to the grand universe. Right? And really small relative to the master universe.
At this stage.
Yeah, right? So, all right, just, you know, this is another thing, you know, we have to really start to appreciate how high the vertical hierarchy goes. Right? You're at the bottom rung when you get to a master son. Right? It's the smallest of the small in personalized deity terms, right? Really small stuff. The master son cannot comprehend the things that an ancient of days can comprehend. Ancient of days is a much bigger mind, a much bigger footprint than a master son. You know, ancients of days are even bigger than a super universe, you know, in many ways, you know. I mean, they're, the 21 of them are common, you know. They really have the beginnings of a recognition of the whole grand universe. It all starts very, very small. You know, it starts that small with personalized deity. It starts a heck of a lot smaller with personalized, not deity, an animal origin creature like us, just barely trying to poke our way up into some personality phenomenon, some quasi-deity related phenomenon. See, and that's the thing, you know, that personality gives you a more direct relationship to deity. And so if you start to be able to function as a person a little bit more, there's a lot more potential for you, your actions, to be directly feeding into the Almighty, instead of just indirectly, you know, in the whole big picture, but more directly feeding into the Almighty. And so now, it's like that's your upline. You have a duty to see to its quality. You know, do you really want to pollute that line that's feeding in? You know, see to it that you do these things that don't have any meaning for you individually well. You must do them just as well as if they did have meaning for you, because the Supreme is counting on you to do it. There was something else somewhere, yeah?
Yeah, David Jones would like some clarification. How would you speak of this consecration in the real world? Would you say, I want to leave the world a better place because of what I do in my life?
It starts by not trying to leave the world a better place. And like I've said so many times, the world is bigger than the diameter of your wide open mouth. You know, open your mouth as wide as you can and get a ruler out and measure it. See if it's smaller than the diameter of the earth. Step one, don't try to save the earth. Don't try to, you know, do something to the earth, to the whole world. Start small, like the size of your mouth. If you can positively influence another person's life, you know, just one other person's life, in that just that run-of-the-mill prosaic thing, someone needs to mow the lawn in this home every week during the summer. Do you do it? And if so, is life just a little bit more pleasant in the whole neighborhood? Does that mowing the lawn every day have any meaning for you? No, not one bit. But it has a meaning to the Supreme.
Is that where service comes in?
Right, see, an awful lot of service, right, is so that this evolutionary phenomenon can flow through you and the Supreme can evolve. It's, it's not so that you are grown. That's a mistake that a lot of, I'm going to serve because that's character building. No, man cannot cause growth. Right? You can't build your character. You selflessly serve. And you do it all the more selflessly when you recognize, because it has no meaning for you. You're just a means to a greater end, a grand universe-sized end. And you have to just assume that duty. Yours is not the question why. Right? Just do what's in front of you. And recognize that your little embryonic soul is there. It's accumulating the little shreds of meaning, that can somehow manifest in this short little life. The really cool thing you're doing right now, the big thing, is what you're doing for the Supreme. Just because your soul doesn't grow much because of what you're doing, it doesn't mean that what the Supreme gets is equally as small. It's thousands of times greater than what your soul gets. See? So, you do it for the Supreme, not for yourself. There's no sort of reciprocal thing, that you're getting out of it.
So, remember that Christmas movie called It's a Wonderful World, where the guy, what's his name, Jimmy Stewart, goes back and sees what the world was like because he wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, that's kind of what I'm sort of catching a little bit, that there's an awful lot that goes on that you have no idea that goes on because of the repercussions of who you are and what you do.
Right, and ask yourself, why don't you understand all those ramifications? Well, you'd understand them if they were very linear things, but they're not. They're totally nonlinear. They're in the wholeness of the Supreme. That's why they're inscrutable. That's why you don't even know they're there, right? Because it only begins to sort of become tangible when it interacts with 100 trillion other things, and it's all part of the system, the cosmic system, not you.
It really engenders the development of trust.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. See, faith is all about you. Trust is about the whole. Being able to mature faith into trust, you need to make that transition from the father to the mother. Without the recognition and the identification, the consecration towards the mother, there's no way that your faith will ever mature into trust. You'll be stuck there at the initiating step where the father touches you. He's the initiator. And that's all. And you'll be just as fearful and using your faith to antidote your fear just as much on day last as on day first. Right?
I was raised by a Hispanic, very Catholic mother and grandmother, and I always heard as I was going to my parochial school about sacrifice, offering up your pain and suffering. Walking the length of the cathedral on your knees, and all that sort of thing. And I'm just wondering if that is related to the Supreme.
Just notice there's a shade of truth of what I was saying, but notice how it's gotten corrupted by sin, sacrifice, and atonement, that ancient religious thought. To do what's valuable and meaningful for the Supreme doesn't involve sacrifice.
But the intent.
Right. Right. But in a genuine way. To just let go of thinking about how it has some individuation thing where I have to sacrifice. No, just let it be. Just let yourself be part of a system. Let yourself be part of a means to an end. You know, all you have to be is what you are. You don't have to do something different. You know, I have to change myself. I have to not do such and so. I have to sacrifice. No, you don't have to change anything. Just be what you are. If you're an accountant, just be an accountant, right? Most of that is not going to have anything to do with, it's not going to have survival value. It's part of the supreme. If you're a post hole digger, be a post hole digger. Whatever it is, just let yourself be what naturally is part of the system. The people in my town need someone to make shoes, so I make shoes. And I spend my whole life making shoes. None of the shoes are buried with me. None of the shoes are there with me when I wake up on the first mansion world. There's no plaque honoring how well I made shoes on the first mansion world. No, it doesn't have any meaning for you as an individual. It's just part of the system. Just let yourself be part of the system. Yeah. Something else?
So Winston's wondering about if we recognize it, why would it start in that unconscious experience and not in our consciousness? Chris, would it be better if it was in the conscious life? Why or why not?
Obviously part of your conscious life is part of this feeding into the Supreme too. Just take the light in how much you're doing that you're not aware of. How much you're doing for the Supreme that you're not aware of. See, you couldn't even potentially think of it as a sacrifice. You're not even aware of its existence in your mind. There's an experience there that's part of the evolution of the Supreme. You're doing great things for the Supreme and you're completely oblivious to it. How cool is that?
That's cool.
Good. So when you think, well, my life, it's not only is it meaningless for me, it's just pure meaningless. No, you're basing it upon that thin little slice of consciousness. Most of it is unconscious, and it's of all kinds of usefulness to the Supreme. You have no idea of how much of an impact you're making on the evolution of the Supreme, and you're completely oblivious, and you always will be.
Yeah. So when we're doing our best, does it have a different flavor to that, to when you're doing like that, versus when you're being a sloth?
Yeah, the way it works is your mind has a lot of unity to it and has a lot of innate holistic character. So even though you're only conscious of a little phase of it, if you do what you're conscious of well, that bleeds into the whole mindal self. It sets up motions in the whole unconscious parts of your mindal self that make them work more in conformity with the cosmos. And so those experiences that you're unaware of there have more of a natural synchronization with the evolution of the Supreme.
And you say harmony?
Right, harmony, right. There's a harmony in your whole mind if there's a harmony in the part of your mind that you're conscious of. So tend to that well, the part that you are conscious of, and trust that impacts the whole mindal self. And hence redounds greatly to the Supreme. If mind wasn't so unity-like, that wouldn't be the case. But because it functions in such a holistic way, you can take a hold of the part that you're conscious of and have an impact on all of it. All right. One paragraph. Okay, but...
Was that first sentence?
You start off right where you ended up. I keep saying to myself, gosh, I hope I don't get too senile. I don't remember anything when I get there.
Yeah. Souls don't get senile. Right? I mean, see, that's the thing. You just didn't know that. It allows you to age and die more gracefully too. You're so desperately trying to somehow hold on. It's like, well, I got to try to hold on to this because it's got to wake up on the first match. Well, no, just let it be. It's fine. Just everything of survival value, you know, all the you that's savable as a copy of the soul, it's all been saved. It's not subject to the second law of thermodynamics or the degradation of the relationship of life animation to material matter. I mean, it's not impacted by any of that, you know. If you set up something in that soul, it's there for all eternity unless you destroy it, right? It has no degradation. It'll, you know, it stands for eternal.
And yet it must be real because an angel gets a hold of it.
Right, yeah, it's a literal thing, so that an angel can get a hold of it. You know, we're going to read about that in a minute here, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
If we ever get there.
All right, so let's go to the next paragraph here.
The very center of all activities on the first mansion world is the resurrection hall, the enormous temple of personality assembly. This gigantic structure consists of the central rendezvous of the seraphic destiny guardians, the thought adjusters, and the archangels of the resurrection. The life carriers also function with these celestial beings in the resurrection of the dead.
Okay, so just like we were on Gerasim when they were giving us some of the, you know, structures that were there with the circles and whatnot, right? So you've got this, you know, enormous resurrection hall, as you're about to explain some more. You know, we all know the basics. You know, you've got to have the seraphim there because they've got your soul. You have to have the thought adjusters there. Obviously, they've got to plug back in. The archangels are there because they're overseeing once it's all assembled and reengaged. You know, they check to make sure that the exact same personality patterns are in play that were before, and they testify to that. And of course, the life carriers are there because there's this whole bit of building the body, and there's other beings that they don't mention that are going to be literally technicians and all that and stuff, building your Marantia body. That angel is going to be very intimate in putting that Marantia brain into that Marantia body. And the thought adjuster will engage it all again. All right, so that's all happening. What about this, a little bit more about that they haven't given us before, about who's in possession of what? A little bit more technical language.
The mortal mind transcripts and the active creature memory patterns as transformed from the material levels to the spiritual are the individual possession of the detached thought adjusters. These spiritized factors of mind, memory, and creature personality are forever a part of such adjusters. The creature mind matrix and the passive potentials of identity are present in the Marantia soul entrusted to the keeping of the seraphic destiny guardians. And it is in the reuniting of the Marantia soul trust of the seraphim and the spirit-mind trust of the adjuster that reassembles creature personality and constitutes resurrection of a sleeping survivor.
Okay, so notice there's a lot more technical about it here than they are anywhere else in the book. And notice, first of all, before you try to penetrate all the details, there's a common theme there. Notice it's all about mind. What's actually ascending, right? A personalized mindal self is what's ascending through the cosmos, right? Not a body. It's a personalized mindal self. You know, there's this selfhood that threads up through the ascension, the unity of that sequence of personalized mindal self. You go from this mortal self that's personalized right now, next, that Marantia self on the first mansion world, personality will engage it, where it doesn't engage it right now. It will engage it in the next life. And so that's the next personalized mindal self. And then there's a personalized mind of self after that, et cetera. What's ascending is a personalized mind of self. And it's like, well, but a mind is not a substance. How can I think about that as something that's ascending, you know, a thing that's ascending? Right, I mean, recognize how this works. I mean, it's her mind energy. And you are ascending up through it as sort of this quasi-individuated domain within it. Right? You're still in her mindal womb. All in the whole local universe. You aren't birthed out of there. You know, you don't experience mindal birth until you leave the local universe. You know, and so it's only at that point that you can really kind of think of yourself as this definitive thing that's going to be moving up. Before that, you know, it's more like this little, you know, however you want to visualize it, sort of bubble in the mind energy that's floating up. Right? You are trusting her, right, to, when they build this Marantia body, put that Marantia brain into it, Marantia mind seats on it, you're trusting that everything is done just so that a mindal self will form again in that Marantia mind energy that is you up one notch, right? Your mindal self did not get carried up. That foundation, that Marantia brain got carried up, but there's, you know, it's not conscious. There's no mind. It's just a blob of Marantia substance. You know, any more than your material brain is conscious of anything. It's just a seat, right? And so here's how they describe this. See, what does the adjuster have? The adjuster has, quote unquote, the mortal mind transcripts and the active creature memory patterns. Okay, so if you use the hourglass analogy of your adjutant mind right now, right, in the upper domain, that's the spiritualized mind. When they said right there, those two things, as transformed from the material levels to the spiritual, okay, your basic material mind is in the lower domain of the hourglass, the spiritualized mind is in the upper domain. So as you have been, translated up, you know, as an expression in that upper domain of spiritualized mind, where the personality is identified. The adjuster is aware of the mind forms in that spiritualized mind. It literally, incorporates those mindal forms into its being. So that it's a template, and then it turns around and uses its pattern that it acquired to make a copy in Marantia substance. Right? So it knows the mortal mind transcripts because it had to very precisely measure it and acquire that in order to make the soul. So it's in possession of the form of your spiritualized mind. Now, and the memories that are associated with that spiritualized mind, not the memories that are only associated with the unspiritualized, you know, quote unquote, more material mind in the lower domain. So that's what it has. And the actual object of Marantia substance, the soul, you know, no mind seated on it, just the soul. The angel has that, the seraphim have that. And see, and that's described as the creature mind matrix. Okay, now literally the word matrix, you know, means womb. Okay, but it's come to be used, and the revelators use it in distinction from womb, when they want a word that's not womb but womb-like. And humans have done the same thing. You know, most of the time we don't literally use it as a synonym for womb anymore, right? We use it for a womb-like word, and the revelators do also. So you've got this literal Marantia structure that's a mind matrix. It's a structure in Marantia substance, which is kind of like mind-made substance, it's in such a pattern that when Marantia mind engages, seats itself on it, is taught by that matrix, is attuned to that matrix, a mindal self reforms, predicated on that pattern, right? Which is the mindal self that we want to represent you, that ascending mindal self. Right? See, so it's kind of like that Marantia mindal self is not in a womb, but it's sort of like in quote unquote and conforming with that matrix that defines it. In the same way that your DNA, right? Right, when your agitated mind engages your DNA, you know, and is taught by it, is, you know, conforms to it, is attuned to it, right? Okay, so it's sort of within the matrix of that that your Marantia mindal self reforms. See, so it's womb-like. Okay, and passive potentials of identity. Even though personality is not directly identified with your Marantia self right now. You know, that's just an entity, not a being right now. It's, you know, what that whole Marantia mind and the soul that it's seated on is a copy of your personalized self of spiritualized mind in the upper domain, right? So it's definitely like that pattern. So the personality can easily identify with that Marantia self on the first mansion world and make that Marantia self now an identity, right, when personality engages it. See, so right now it's a potential identity because it is very much like that personal self for the, you know, that you have right now in the agitated mind. And in the next life, it will actually be an identity. Right now you have a material identity. In the next life, you'll have a Marantia identity. Okay, see, so they're just spelling out those specifics, exactly how to think about how it is that you can get everything back in play like it was before.
When the Ranch book refers to the, you can have the mind of Jesus, is this what you're referring to?
No, now that is... In the upper domain of the hourglass analogy of your mind, that's the domain that can synchronize with the wholeness of truth. Okay, the mind of Jesus, went all the way to fusion, right? So think about how completed, in relative terms, the upper, you know, the motions of mind were in the upper domain of his hourglass. I mean, how synchronized with truth they were, you know, that his mind energy was. You would like to have a mind energy that is similarly synchronized with truth, to take on the mind of Jesus. Well, you have something that he didn't have. You have the spirit of truth to actually catalyze, help you with that. So, you know, in a way it's saying, you know, borrow the mind of Jesus, supply the favorable conditions for the spirit of truth to function and help you to get that holistic, truth-like nature in the upper domain of the hourglass so that you can think in a holistic way like he could. Right? So... You know, they speak of it in that terms of borrowing. You know, it's not like you can go and find his mind on the shelf somewhere where it's still sitting. And but so you can get catalyzed towards that by opening yourself up more to the spirit of truth, supplying the favorable conditions of consecrating your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother, of taking delight in cultivating your relationship to the three cosmic intuitions, those prerequisites for the spirit of truth being able to function. And it will. As soon as you give it a chance, it will help you. But you gotta give it a place first. It can't force you to, you know, to take delight in cultivating your relationship to the three cosmic intuitions. All right. So you so just, you know, when you say Marantia Soul Trust and Spirit Mind Trust, you know, and Marantia's like mind made substance. See, just the whole thing, see, is if you just reflect on it, it's trying to really get you to recognize what is it that ascends. It's a long ways from some simplistic notion of bodily resurrection. And it takes a lot of sophistication of understanding to even appreciate how this could work. I mean, you've got to have the whole kind of physics system of mind, energy, and everything to understand how this could all, how you could be resurrected in this very non, seemingly non-direct way. The only thing that's direct is that blob of Marantia substance. It's the only thing that's directly there that's here, right? And then when you, it's like, well, okay, that's okay. Oh, but that's not what's what my mind is seated on right now. See, so it's like, I mean, there just isn't anything direct about the resurrection that they describe here from what humans have always imagined. Okay? It all is fundamentally indirect, but you have to trust, you know, and that trust is shown to be not in, you know, not in vain when the archangel says, yep, everything is perfect, you know. The archangel testifies that every I has been dotted, every T has been crossed, right down exactly, precisely, there's Maria again, or there's Chris again. You know, at least in terms of what's really you. And you'll quickly not, you know, mourn the loss of all that stuff that's not there.
You won't miss the donut.
Yeah, you won't. And and then, of course, you know, we all know that you can go look up the records and you can reacquire some of the, you know, that more foundational stuff too, right? But anyway, all right. So that's the gist of it.
You're anything else? Mind, and yep. So I'm just curious, you know, and I can understand that, picture that, you know, you're, as John Lennon said, it's all in the mind, George. But my question is, you get different minds, though. In other words, you're like, thank God, because I can't remember anything. He's mm-hmm. coming.
Right.
You know, and as we evolve, we get, I would imagine, better minds, I guess you would say.
Yeah.
So, in a way, but and yet, so it's not really your mind that necessarily, it's your personality that stays, keeps it you, right? Or keeps,
well, there's two things that are, there's two things that don't change.
Okay.
The selfhood, which is that common thread of mindal selves, that's changeless, and your personality. Yeah, but again, you got to remember, the thing that, you know, you're thinking of ascending, the thing that's coming bottom up is the selfhood, not the personality. That's an that's just an influence from eternity.
And your thought adjuster.
It's coming from the time. Well, yeah, the thought adjuster, of course. You know, but it's until you fuse, that's not you,
right?
So, you know, so there's, see, another way to think about it. There's the, you know, the fact that it's you that's resurrected. That there's a commonness between that next self and this self. That commonness is called the selfhood. The selfhood, you know. You can think of it as a continuous fact that's moving up, whereas selves are discontinuous. There's this self, and then it's not there anymore. Then there's the next self, and then it's not there anymore. But there's a threaded through that is a quote-unquote selfhood.
Even though in the minds may be different.
Right? It's a totally different mind energy system, and, you know, literally a different, you know, space within the mind energy system, you know, in which your consciousness, right? But there's this common thread, and that is a setup by the creative mother spirit. She's the one that forms your selfhood at roughly age 6. And it's a supreme thread. Right? So relative to all finite changes, it doesn't change. It's at the ceiling of the finite. It's changeless relative to the finite. So its changelessness can meet the absolute changelessness of the personality. Changeless can meet changeless. Right? There's some, a personality technically can't identify with a self because that's, you know, those are, they're not of like kind. A changeless fact of self, of personality, has to engage another changeless fact, like to like. It's that changeless selfhood that it actually is technically identified with. Yeah. Okay, so that initial thread that you're given by grace, see that initial thread of selfhood, you know, is what you can, you know, if you want to think of it as, you know, sort of like a, you know, literally like a thread, you know, yourselves are hung upon it, you know, like a, with a hanger, you know, and you slide along that thread of selfhood as you ascend, however you want to analogize it. all right, so let's see, anything else there? Yes, so, you know, just the way they're saying at the end, that constitutes resurrection. So, you know, they're, you know, that's like I said, they're trying to say you've got all kinds of notions of what constitutes resurrection. This is technically what it is. This is what constitutes resurrection and no other wishful thinking. Just this. And they're just challenging you to be comfortable that you will find this to be appropriate.
Well, it's going to happen. You're not really going to be conscious of the actual steps happening. Right? You're just going to wake up and it's going to be done.
Yeah, I mean, you won't even really be aware of just how different it is, right, until you start looking back in the records, you know, at your old mortal self and its experiences and stuff, and, you know, and begin to recognize the contrast, right? Because the one little qualification of that is, even though you're not very conscious, you know, if at all, of the existence of that other self, that Mirage self right now, it's not bidirectional. It's aware of you. Its eyes are your eyes, right? That's another mindful self, and it can see. It sees through your eyes. It feels through your fingers. It smells through your nose, right? You know, it's a lot like...
It experiences through you.
Right. I mean, you know, through your agent of mind, you know, it has a way down and out, you know, through the sensory mechanisms. See, so it's a lot like if there's a finaliter standing in the room, the finaliter can see us, but we can't see it. See? It's a similar thing. The soul can see you, but you can't see the soul right now. That's another way. See, it is you. I mean, it's seeing what you're seeing.
Is that your mercy?
What was that?
Is it at your mercy?
Yeah, I mean, it has no personality.
Yes.
So if you will it positively, you know, it has a positive experience. If you will it negatively, it has a negative experience, and it can't do anything about it. In the same way, you know, the adjuster is always subservient to your will. So if your will is negative, the adjuster faithfully, you know, impacts your soul like that. If you would like a chip out of your soul, if you genuinely will it, the adjuster picks up a hammer and knocks a chip out of your soul, precisely the way you instructed it to. Every measure of creativity has an equal measure of destructivity. So the soul will faithfully reflect you, both positive and negatively. And maybe just before we go on, that's another thing to notice. They're not going to focus on the negative side here. But keep in mind, as we read through these mansion worlds, you know, especially on the first mansion world, there's going to be some individuals going to iniquity, definitely, on that first mansion world. Right? They're going to start up with a soul that's seared from a lot of sin, genuine sin, not, you know, imaginary sin in this life. You know, that seared soul is resurrected. It picks up right where it left off. You know, and it'll either start to turn itself around, you know, or continue down the path it was on and go to iniquity in short order on the first mansion world. Yeah, but they keep it positive. You know, it's, you know, as you read it, it's as if everyone is, you know, in a positive. But remember, there are those who are on a negative track. You're mortal until you fuse.
Yeah.
You know, and you don't, you know, there isn't a lot of fusion going on until the fifth mansion world. Right? So technically anyone before, you know, before fusion can turn it all around and go to iniquity. You know, you're mortal still. You're not immortal until you fuse.
Or refuse.
Yes, you fuse or refuse.
Almost
took my line. when you think, well, how in the world somebody who had gotten to imagine worlds possibly look around them and for more than 2 seconds flat have to make an, oh yeah, this is great, I'll take it. Take three. But not the case. It's if indeed mm-hmm. your soul arrives in a deformed sort right. of yeah. very frail condition, it could very, I can see it more so right mm-hmm. now than mm-hmm. I ever have in the past. Mm-hmm. It could continue straight on and say, right. oh, that's crap, that's kind of... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but, and again, you know, that's fairly easy to understand like that. If it starts out seared, it'll you know continue down that path.
Possibly.
But remember, it has free will.
It can also
in the same way that a human in this life can reject all of the positive potentials of this life, say, I don't care about anything except me. You know, and not just in an animal sense am I selfish. I'm going to will that selfishness. I'm going to choose to be selfish. I'm going to take, instead of consecrating myself to the whole and righteousness, I'm going to consecrate myself wholeheartedly to self, and I'm going to be self-righteous. I mean, you know, we are rejecting just as much positive things in our environment here as there are to reject in that environment there. See, that's another thing. Remember, you're not going from earth to heaven. You're just going to the next earth. Right? It's just as easy to look around there and say, what's the big deal with this place?
That's not what I was told. I mean, our ladies of the open wounds. Sorry.
Right? We have to understand, right, that, you know, we're not in that binary model anymore, you know, where it's heaven and earth. Right? You're going to a next earth. You know, and it's just as easy to not be impressed by the environment there as it is to be not impressed by the environment here. It's like, well, how could that be? Well, see, you get an upgraded mind, but you get an upgraded environment. Right? See, so it's on equal footing again. Your mind right now matches this environment, and lots of people reject the positive of this environment. Same thing there, right? It won't be, this consciousness is not going to wake up there and go, wow, who could ever reject? That's why people think no one, because they're taking this consciousness there. No, you're going to take a consciousness that meets that environment at eye level and says, this is no big deal, this is just like me, right? If anything, I can look back at those lower selves on nativity worlds, and I'm higher than that, all the more reason to be self-righteous. Look how great I am now.
It's a Mirangian with an attitude.
Right. You can still choose. Right?
And the prison is so close.
Was Lucifer, you know, impressed by the fact that his mother and father were the Creator Son and Creator Mother Spirit? No. Not at all. Completely matter of fact, there's nothing profound there at all. The thing that was really cool was me, you know, himself. That's the thing he was impressed by, not mom and dad. Right? He's a child of self-love. You can love yourself even more when you have more self to love. Right? There's not much self to fall in love with right now. Wait till you're really a cool self. Now you can really fall in love with yourself. If you're as cool a self as a Lananadec, there's a lot to fall in love with there. I mean, you're a radiant spiritual being. When you look at yourself and you cast this brilliant spiritual shadow, you know, around you, I mean, it's like, wow, look at that. Right? How great am I? Right? I stand before angels and they weep at my beauty. How could I not love myself? Right, I mean, this is where his mind went. Same place your mind can go.
So service motive is our protection against
that? Yeah. Turn your back on yourself. Think about others. Yeah. Yep.
So David's trying to process this idea of the seared soul in the next
yep.
earth.
Yep.
How's that impacting... others? Does that create pain for yourself and others?
Remember that one point they say they will resurrect the most horrendously seared soul, knowing full well that has basically zero probability of not going to iniquity. They would sooner risk a system rebellion because of that than to not resurrect that. Do they trust the integrity of the whole? Yes, they do. Right? So you'll meet some really grotesque souls on that first mansion world. Things that have got resurrected, you're thinking, why on earth would you resurrect that? Right? But it's an opportunity for you, if nothing else, to stand unmoved in the presence of that. You know, that's going to be a little silver tongue on the first mansion world. Are you sophistry proof? Are you going to get sucked in by that fancy little seared soul?
And as you said earlier, there's always a chance for rehabilitation. You never know what
exactly. Yes.
What caused that soul to get
there. He's not iniquity. He's not an empty soul yet. There's something there still. It means it's not a zero probability. I mean, they can turn themselves around, you know.
And that's what they're there.
Until there's nothing to turn around, you can turn it around. You know, iniquity means there's nothing there anymore. So, duh, it can't be turned around. There's nothing to turn, you know, it's literally zero.
And, you know, all the forces that be, what did Jesus say? All that you've given me, I shall not lose one.
Mm-hmm.
Are working to try and turn that person around.
If it exists, it's resurrected. The only thing that isn't resurrected is that which doesn't exist. Because it's a little hard to hold on to something that doesn't exist, right? Right? Okay.
If a transitory personality of mortal origin should never be thus reassembled, the spirit elements of the non-surviving mortal creature would forever continue as an integral part of the individual experiential endowment of the one-time indwelling adjuster.
Okay, so just a little tidbit. You know, obviously the point here is to not spend a lot of time talking about adjusters. That's what the adjuster papers are for. But, you know, just that little reminder, like we were saying, the fact that the mortal mind transcripts and the active creature memory patterns are in the possession of the adjuster. If the adjuster has a hold of something, there's no slipping through fingers or anything. You know, I mean, it couldn't drop it if it wanted to, right? It's been eternalized by being glued to the adjuster. So they're just reminding you of that if an individual doesn't survive, that goes on, and it's not just all the positive that adjuster got from that individual that went to iniquity, which is huge. Remember, it makes him a supreme adjuster. But there is also the reflection of all the positive elements of that life that went up through the supreme creator personalities and became part of the summation that is the Almighty. And then the purposing, you know, that was identified with that self, that personality, also becomes part of God the Almighty, right? So you have two copies of the meanings and values, really, that are saved. One in the possession of the adjuster, the other in the, you know, as part of the summation in the Almighty. And the personality, you know, identifies with the copy of the meanings and values that are with the Almighty. And, you know, it's in that mode that you can really directly see that you really didn't have a separate individual evolving there. When all is said and done, the meanings, values, and the purposing identified to it are part of God the Almighty. You know, you weren't watching Lucifer evolve, say. You were watching part of God the Almighty evolve. And you can tell that when all is said and done. Right? That was just a lump in the Supreme, you know, like they're saying, a transitory, you know, personality, personalized, quasi, you know, individuated lump of God the Almighty. You know, it was a drop that blended back into the ocean, you know, because it really wasn't ever separated from the ocean, right? It really was just the ocean all the time. Okay, so.
Not even figment.
Yeah, I mean, it's Lucifer is not a figment of everyone's imaginations. Lucifer was real. But when all is said and done, it's like, well, technically, it's not Lucifer that was real, because he's not part of eternity. It's God the Almighty that was real. You know, and it's like, well, yeah, but Lucifer was all negative. No. Yeah, that's when you look at it, you know, from a short span of time. You know, already there's more goodness from the rebellion than all the negative that will ever result from the rebellion. Right? This is another reminder, right, that it's God the Supreme that's evolving there, not technically a separate individual. You know, and when you look at it in circumscribed space and time, it doesn't look positive to anyone, even high beings. But someone who can see the whole picture, right, they don't see it as negative. Every, you know, when you can encompass the whole finite, everything in your vision is positive.
That gives to me that expression that for every adversity, there's an equal or greater equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't ever put that to the Supreme, even though it also seems to hold true in life individually, but for the Supreme, it's really true.
Yeah, remember, you know, that technically the acts are ours, the consequences are God's. You know, the God we're talking about there is not God the Father. That's God the Supreme. Yeah. You know, they remind you of that up in the Supreme Papers, that technically that's the God we're talking about there. And that's what we're describing here. Right? You have all these acts, you know, that are really not you evolving, they're the Supreme evolving. All right, let's get some more here.
From the Temple of New Life, there extend seven radial wings, the resurrection halls of the mortal races. Each of these structures is devoted to the assembly of one of the seven races of time. There are 100,000 personal resurrection chambers in each of these seven wings, terminating in the circular class assembly halls, which serve as the awakening chambers for as many as 1 million individuals. These halls are surrounded by the personality assembly chambers of the blended races of the normal post-Adamic worlds. Regardless of the technique which may be employed on the individual worlds of time in connection with special or dispensational resurrections, the real and conscious reassembly of actual and complete personality takes place in the resurrection halls of Mansonia number 1. Throughout all eternity, you will recall the profound memory impressions of your first witnessing of these resurrection mornings.
Okay, let's deal with the second half of that first here. Okay, regardless of the technique which may be employed, one of those is an example that you might think of there. Is their description of the dispensational resurrection, you know, with Jesus' resurrection. Okay? They're pointing out, you know, that sometimes there can be all kinds of special things going on. I mean, think about how many different things were going on there with that dispensational resurrection. You had all these beings that were on this world instead of on the first mansion world because Jesus was here and Gabriel was here. Remember how they mentioned that? Yeah. And people often get confused. It's like, well, okay, are they resurrected right there and then transported? No. Right? No matter what goes on the world, the nativity world, yeah, like they're saying here, the real and conscious reassembly. I mean, the actual resurrection is happening in the resurrection halls on the first mansion world. Right? Doesn't matter if there's archangel circuits, you know, or Gabriel present or anything like that. I mean, everyone that died, you know, that wasn't already resurrected from Adam and Eve's dispensational resurrection to Michael, to Jesus's, was needed to have a body built for them in the resurrection halls. You know, their seraphim that had possession of their soul had to be there. Remember how they'd mentioned that a lot of them had to, you know, get transported there with their souls, you know. I mean, so they get transported there. That seraphim has to be there to put the soul into the body. Right? I mean, it's all literally, scientifically happening on the first mansion world, regardless of what's going on the nativity world. Okay, and you know, and they're just mentioning in passing. Remember, there's really three kinds. Well, you could say four. Four kinds of resurrection. There's, you could be resurrected just as an individual. You know, if you can, if you're like a third circler, if you have your own pair of seraphim, you know, there's three different ways that you can have your own pair of seraphim. If you have your own pair of seraphim, obviously you can ascend as an individual. You don't have to be part of a group, right? So you can be resurrected on the third period. Right, the day you die, the day you're resurrected, and the time it takes to transport your soul there in between. Right? So there's that kind of resurrection, where you're resurrected just as an individual. You know, and they mentioned you have these individual resurrection chambers, for instance, for that. Then there are the dispensational resurrections. There's millennial resurrections, millennial in the sense of, you know, the roughly 1,000 years it takes for the first circuit of Avona to go around, and everyone doing things synchronized with that, that Havona, Paradise Havona Day. And then there's just plain old special resurrections, where there's some group of beings that they want on the mansion worlds, independent of whether or not they can get there, you know, individually. And they'll resurrect a special group, like Moses and a group got specially resurrected like that. So there's four different ways that there can be a resurrection. And so you see here, you've got that whole central region, they give you a name for, the Temple of New Life, where kind of everyone congregates, the rendezvous place in the center of this vast structure. And then out from that, you know, probably circular central structure, you've got these seven radial wings. You know, vast. There's 100,000 personal resurrection chambers in each of these seven wings. So if you were resurrected as taken there as an individual and resurrected, and you were still basically one of the seven pure line races, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, you would be resurrected in one of those radial wings. Okay, if it was a multiple resurrection, but still red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, or violet, there's, as they say, at the end of those, you know, linear radial wings, there's a circular chamber that's just for that race, for group resurrections. See that? Seven wings terminating in the circular class assembly halls. And then in some geometry they don't totally describe, some massive building area that goes all the way around all of this whole thing. See, these halls are surrounded by the personality assembly chambers of the blended races. And so there's going to be individual and group chambers in this some vast structure that goes all the way around it. You know, probably some big circular ring or something, I suppose, you know.
That's what we are.
Yeah, and that's where all, you know, we will be. I mean, and our world is really different because we had a quote-unquote pre-blended race. You know, the Andonites. See, the Andonites would have been resurrected there. You know, but normally, like they're saying, you don't have any significant blending of peoples until Adam and Eve come to a world and start to really aggressively, you know, foster blending into one race. So that, you know, naturally the races stick to themselves. They prefer just sexually, you know, prefer the beauty of that of their race, you know, and mate with their race. So, you know, for a long time, you know, you people are really in these distinct wings on a world. But we've, you know, we're one of those worlds that probably used those separate wings the least of, you know, of any world. Because almost immediately you had Sangiks mating with Andonites, right? You know, and... right? You know, so, you know, you go, it's like, well, how does that work? It's like, wait a minute. I mean, you know, they basically say that that's how the seven races got us, I mean, the six Sangic races got established, is you had the initial progenitors of each of the race, but when they mated with the Andonites, you know, the offspring, you know, had the skin color and whatnot of the progenitors. It's like, well, you know, it leaves you a little confused. It's like, well, did we ever have any really kind of pure races? It's a little hard to know how to think about our world at all. I don't know. But anyway.
They said that the hue, or beneath the skin of everyone, there's a melanoma.
Well, you have the basic melanin of the Andite race. Everyone has that, right? But you know, because we're all descendants from the Andonites. But those additional pigments, yeah. And again, now you go, well, what is skin pigment? You know, why would skin pigment have anything to do with the first mansion world? It doesn't, right? Are we resurrecting bodies with skin pigments? No. What are we resurrecting? Mindal cells. Oh. So it isn't just skin deep, right? The seven races are seven different flavors of mindal cells. And we've talked about this, right? I mean, each race favors one of the seven adjutants, right? So you have a distinctly different type of mindal self. And it is so different. Well, why do they have to have these separate wings? I mean, they must have seen some sort of an environmental energy going on when they're building and resurrecting these bodies. And you can't have those energies overlapping, those environments. They would pollute each other if you didn't have them in separate buildings. You would literally have the wrong kind of mind energy environment that you're sort of coalescing into a being if they didn't have them separate. The races, you know, have a distinctly different flavor of mind.
Maybe that's, somehow tied to, you know, when they were talking previously about the structural and the form, the triangles, the circles, it kind of reinforces that idea of structure and energy.
Right, right. In ways that we can't understand, there's nothing arbitrary about the shapes of any of these structures or buildings or anything. You know, there's some sort of power personality synthesis going on where, in order for it to do what it does, the building has to be shaped that way. I mean, those circles have to be circles. They couldn't be what they are if they were triangles.
And they're separate. And
we just don't understand that.
They're separate individual forms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's something profound, you know, about these various geometric shapes and stuff, and how it relates to all of the energies. All right,
I've always wondered too if they didn't do some kind of special group resurrection for the beginning people of the Urantia book, and maybe if they weren't individual enough. But they were fulcrum. They were an axis or a change.
Or
this revelation to come, you know.
Or they could have just been a local means to them. Remember, the only reason that they have a special resurrection is because there's something of significance to those individuals on the mansion worlds. Not that they were significant individuals on their nativity world. Right? Moses wasn't resurrected in a special resurrection because he was a special individual on the Nativity world. He was resurrected in a special resurrection because he's very special there. And you know how special he was there. He ends up being one of the 420 counselors, right?
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, it's...
But something that he gained through probably the individuality of the whole... that he personally gained,
right? I mean, it's the same way when Jesus says that John the Baptist was this really profound individual, and you look at his life and you shrug, what's the big deal? I mean, I could have, you know, eaten locusts and honey and, you know, and been the boys crying in the wilderness. I mean, you know, I mean, what's so difficult about that? Right? He's profound not because of his life here. Most of that life here had no meaning for him as an individual. It was just part of the evolution of the Supreme, right? It doesn't make him profound. I mean, yeah, it's what he was, you know, the potential that was there is what made him profound. I mean, Jesus was speaking to his potential, not his actuality. You know, so you got to keep that in mind. You have value not because of what you are, but what you're becoming, you know, what you can become. So, I mean, you know, they're no respecter of persons. I mean, they don't care if you did all kinds of really groovy things on this planet. If you don't have anything, you know, if there isn't something special for you on the fifth mansion world, say, you know, you wait for the 200,000 years, right? Doesn't matter. You know, if you were seminal in keeping civilization alive on that planet or something, I mean, that may be your moment, you know, and it doesn't transfer to the mansion worlds. You're just one of the crew on the mansion worlds. You know, and so that's one of the adjustments you'll have to make. It's like, well, wait a minute, you know who I am? You know, I'm Alexander the Great. And they go, yeah, okay, everyone's the Great. Yeah. Pull the number. Number, wow, that's a lot of digits. Yeah, that's a lot of digits. Get in line. Alexander the yada, yada, yada. All right. So. Yeah, okay, let's keep going here. Well, oh, do you have something? Oh.
In the first part of that, mm-hmm. It's always seemed to me that 100,000 was such a small number of waking chambers, you know, especially for any kind of, you know, resurrection from this planet where they got to be resurrecting billions.
Well, no, but remember, those are individual ones.
Right, but still,
remember what they,
the ones on the outside.
Yeah, I know.
It only goes up to 1 million, right, Eric?
Right, well, yeah, you know, at a time.
Yeah.
I mean, think of the logistics of building... You know, and reassembling.
Well, yeah, right.
Like, you know, and you go a million. Okay, next billion. Next.
So
you know.
When they do it,
in the course of a day, you can resurrect a lot of millions.
Well, when they do a dispensational resurrection from right. A planet like this,
right?
You know, let's say there's got to be, you know, 30, 40 billion people going at one time because it's by the time they do them.
Right, but they don't have to resurrect them all at once. You know. Yeah, you know, literally in the same instant.
They're just standing there and getting in line.
Remember how fast they can launch transport seraphim.
764.
Not that fast. Can't be that many in a day, as I recall. It's like.
Right. But no. I don't mean that. I mean just, you know, in terms of the efficiency. You know.
Okay. I agree with you.
Right. See, just remember that they could. You know. I mean, and is there any? You know, do they have to get it done? You know, in a certain no. You got all the time in the world, right? You know, if it takes, I mean, who knows? Maybe it takes them, you know, several weeks to resurrect everyone.
So
what? Whatever. Right? Right. I mean, remember that.
So it's not, okay.
With a dispensational resurrection, some of the individuals that are part of that dispensational resurrection haven't even died on the nativity world yet. Right, you yeah. Judge the living and the dead in a dispensational resurrection. You know all the, because the whole system changes when a dispensation changes. It's not just an arbitrary line. You resurrect in the dispensational resurrection all the individuals before the physics changed. You know, in the mind energy system. You know, so you know, there's a whole bunch of people that haven't even died yet that are going to be part of that dispensational resurrection. So that shows you how long it's spread out. I mean, you know, let's say they live another 30 years and it takes, say, 5 years to transport their soul. You know, they're part of that dispensational resurrection, but, you know, they're way down the line. So, yeah.
Well, it's our bias to our unity consciousness that makes us anxious about this process.
Yeah.
Because to the material consciousness just sees it as a problem and solves it, and there's time as a part of that process. It's not insurmountable. It's just what you do.
Yeah, so it'll take however long it takes, and I'm sure there's physics reasons. I mean, you know, where, you know, like when they, you know, when they say that it, you know, as many as 1 million individuals in those class assembly halls, You know, it's like, well, why couldn't they make the building bigger and make it 10 million? I'm sure there's some physics reason why you can't. I mean, you know, and we'll understand that. You know, energy conduits, you know, are unstable if they're bigger. I mean, who knows what the heck it is? Yeah, yeah, yeah. So. Yeah, right, and there's all the issue of companions and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, though, but the thing about the one thing I wanted to mention, the 100,000 does seem like a really small number. You know, it's important to remember that there aren't that many third circlers or better. You know, I mean, one of the most startling statements in the book is when you finally get to the paper on you know, light and life, and it says, "Okay, now finally." Seraphim start coming in greater numbers to a planet because there's more people that reach third circular during their, you know, mortal life. You're going, what? 500 years on a planet in light and life, and now more are getting to third circular? I see. Right. There's not that many. You know, and even if you throw in the reservists, you know, that have their own personal seraphim, and those who've made a supreme decision to become godlike and have their own personal seraphim. I mean, all three of those groups together doesn't amount to a large number. Even when you've got, say, 200 worlds feeding into this resurrection hall, right? It's not a huge number. Okay? They're just trying to remind you that. Most people sleep till the next dispensation.
Most yep. people sleep while they're here.
yeah, yeah. yep.
Get a head start.
Mm-hmm. Something on the...
Yeah, Winston's wondering, how does value, especially to the Supreme Being, differ from the value that the adjuster stores up in the soul for the Marantia substance?
There's some value. I mean, think of value as something that's the size of the grand universe. If you grab a hold of that sheet of value with your faith grasp, with your personality, you can individuate a hand-sized bit of it. That which you separate out of the value of the whole is your value and gets copied into your soul. That's the values and meanings of the soul are the things that you've actually individuated out of the Supreme's grip. You know, it has a hold on the whole sheet of value, but it will allow you to take part of it, right? Because, you know, it's your mother. You're literally, you know, that's your other parent. You know, and like they tell you up in the Supreme Papers, literally, you, what is coalescing into you is the substance of the Supreme. You know, physical energy, mind energy, spirit energy, all that energy is its energy. It's where it's coming from. You know, it's giving you that energy to make yourself out of. You know, literally that Marantia structure of the soul, that used to be the Supreme's stuff. The Supreme has allowed you to take that and make a soul out of it. You know, it's physical energy, it's spirit energy fibers, right? You know, that's literally the Supreme's stuff that you're made out of. Everything about you is all of your experiential stuff comes from that experiential deity. Yeah, all of your real substance, if you will, is from that parent. Yeah, aside from the adjuster, you know, that personality, you know, is not a stuff that you're getting from the Father. Okay. All right. And even the stuff that you fuse with of the adjuster, all of that experiential stuff, all of its experiential nature that you're actually interacting with and fused to, I mean, that all came from the Supreme too. Right? You're never going to touch the existential stuff at the core of the adjuster that actually came from the Father. You know, it's all Supreme stuff that we're, you know, that we're made out of. Okay. What else do we have here? Okay, so let's see. Yeah, let's keep going.
From the resurrection halls, you proceed to the Melchizedek sector, where you are assigned permanent residence, then you enter upon 10 days of personal liberty. You are free to explore the immediate vicinity of your new home and to familiarize yourself with the program which lies immediately ahead. You also have time to gratify your desire to consult the registry and call upon your loved ones and other Earth friends who may have preceded you to these worlds. At the end of your 10-day period of leisure, you begin the second step in the paradise journey, for the mansion worlds are actual training spheres, not merely detention planets.
They are detention planets.
They are detention planets, but not merely that. Right? You are detained until you've matured to the point that you can go to the next step. But you are, you know, making that progress by through an educational regime. You're being trained. Okay, we all, you know, those who are familiar with the book, we all know about the 10-day period thing. So, yeah, and what's the significance of a 10-day period? That's a
month.
Oh, no, a week. Right.
Well, they're a week.
Right, you know, I mean, 10 days, you know, are a quote-unquote week on high, and 100 days are a year, right? Right, so it's a, you know, it's a, you know, and remember, you know, that's, it's all in gerasim, you know, time and stuff, you know, but that, you know, we need to worry about that right now. This is the whole point, is that, you know, that week thing is playing out there. I mean, that's a significant chunk of time, you know, that 10-day chunk. Let's see, so what else do we have there? Oh yeah, just notice you are free to explore the immediate vicinity of your new home is also, you know, I mean, you obviously can't stray very far, or just logistically this is not going
to
work.
You haven't learned how to walk yet.
And, you know, you can't go off on some field trip, you know, way off somewhere. I mean, you got to be able to be there, you know, at the end of the 10 days to be unplugged and have your soul transported to the next mansion world. Yep.
It talks about maybe looking up your loved ones who have preceded you.
Mm-hmm.
It seems a little bit like that doesn't jive, because if most people are resurrected together, would they have necessarily preceded you? I mean, and you know, in a, because if most of us are sleeping survivors, I mean, how would they have preceded you? And if they did, they'd be so much further ahead of you if you're a sleeping survivor, unless you're right at the time of the dispensation.
Again, just notice it says, who may have preceded you. I mean, you know, and don't, you know, this isn't just talking about us, right?
Well,
I mean,
it says Earth.
What about a world? Yeah, right. Right, but you know, what about a world that, you know, where, you know, it's enlightened life, and basically, you know, a lot of people are all going as individuals, and right, you know, so they're just giving you the general picture, you know.
Okay.
They may, but they may not have, you know. And in our case, like you're understanding, it's not too likely there's anyone you're going to want to look up that's not going to be waking up with you, right? Right. I mean, well, we'll probably be waking up. And whenever the magisterial son finally comes to this world and there's a dispensational resurrection, right, us and everyone who's lived since Jesus was here is going to be resurrected with us. So, you know, unless you know relatives back into the B.C. times.
Long line of resurrection
chambers. Most of us are lucky if we can trace our ancestors, you know, back 1,000 years, you know, let alone 2,000 years. So
you may not answer the page.
Just and of course, you know, just, you know, it's fun to think about the logistics of that. You know, it's not like you can go to some registry, you know, and look at, oh, here's Chris Halverson. You know, I'm not going to be, you know. So there's some way that they are cross referencing, and you can look this up. You know, it's like, well, how do I, you know, look up my relatives, you know, how, what are you known by until you fuse? Your adjuster number, right? So, you know, you're going to be able to, there's going to be some sort of cross-reference, you know, where you'll be able to look up Chris Halverson, you know, on 606 of Satania, adjuster number such and so, and you're going to be able to find the person, you know, it says adjuster number so and so is at these grid coordinates. So, you know, I mean, and you can go there and find them or whatever, right?
Okay.
Okay, you know, I can just stand there and shout, you know, and, like you're in the airport, you know. Barbara, are you here somewhere?
Let's go white paging.
It's a pilot. You can stand there with a sign, you know, like in the airport.
Wait, I wrote this in English. That's not going
to work. Okay. Let's see here. Anything else there? No, you want to keep going here.
On Mansion World number one, or another in case of advanced status, you will resume your intellectual training and spiritual development at the exact level whereon they were interrupted by death. Between the time of planetary death, or translation and resurrection on the Mansion World, mortal man gains absolutely nothing aside from experiencing the fact of survival. You begin over there, right where you leave off down here.
Okay, and I see it's death or translation. You know, those are together. And resurrection. Right? I mean, you could have died or you could have fused. Right? And then you're resurrected. Okay, so just, you know, remember what this, another way of thinking about, you know, what this is of exactly where you left off. Precisely, that's relative to the psychic circles, or the cosmic levels.
Not what paper you're on in the book.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, no, not what paper you're on in the book. But see, when they say intellectual training and spiritual development at the exact level whereon, right, those are the cosmic levels of the psychic circles that they're talking about there. You know, and you know, the intellectual training, you know, should give you a clue to that. And when they say spiritual development, you know, we mean in the sense of the spiritualized mind, the upper domain, you know, in the holistic sense of spiritual development, like Holy Spirit. Right? So not just unity. So it's the cosmic levels, not the spiritual levels. You don't begin on the spiritual level. You begin on the cosmic level that you left off on. Let's see. Is there anything else there? Right. So just that. Just... you know, like I said, I mean, they, you know, they're just giving you more specifically what they were alluding to up above there with, you know, the contrast between the material mind and the spiritual mind, quote unquote. You know, they're just trying to get you to think about, it's the upper domain of the hourglass that's really making progress on the cosmic levels relative to the psychic circles. And it's that upper domain that's being copied into the soul, right? So that progress with the relative to the cosmic levels picks up right where it left off. Where the bottom lower domain of the hourglass left off, it, you know, is just left off, right? That doesn't pick up again. Right? That's the end. All right.
Almost the entire experience of Mansion World Number One pertains to deficiency ministry. Survivors arriving on this first of the detention spheres present so many and such varied defects of creature character and deficiencies of mortal experience that the major activities of the realm are occupied with the correction and cure of these manifold legacies of the life in the flesh on the material evolutionary worlds of time and space.
Do they mention that there's more than two of these things? So many, manifold, and notice the play with the words there, defects and deficiencies, you know, and they have correction and cure. You know, you immediately would think more of correcting deficiencies and curing defects, and I mean defects and deficiencies is really kind of the same root word. You know, why are they giving both? What's sort of the difference there? A deficiency is indicating more of an incompleteness, whereas a defect is indicating more of an imperfection. Right? So, and, you know, those imperfections, those defects, you know, again, they're keeping it positive here, but remember, between the lines is those could be serious sin caused divots in that soul. Okay, so, but it doesn't have to be, the defects don't have to be the result of sin, as you'll see in a minute here. But that's kind of the difference. Incompleteness or imperfection is kind of the way you can think about the difference there. Incompleteness is just a deficiency. You just need, to work on maturing some more. But an imperfection, has to be kind of more focused on specifically. All right.
The sojourn on Mansion World Number 1 is designed to develop mortal survivors at least up to the status of the post-Adamic dispensation on the normal evolutionary worlds. Spiritually, of course, the Mansion World students are far in advance of such a state of mere human development.
Okay, so this is the sequence, we'll see. Each one of these Mansion Worlds, the first ones, is tied to a particular post-sun dispensation. So here's the post-Adamic. So the basic biologic issues that go on in the post-Adamic age
that have
to be addressed here. But then they say, spiritually, of course, Mansion World students are far in advance of such a state, simply because you don't have agitated mind there. You actually have Maranja mind, which just innately has more of a spiritual nature. It's a more spiritualized mind just innately because it's attuned to, a Maranja structure that has spirit fibers in it, right? So that's the main thing about your relationship to unity there. Now here spiritually we mean unity, not cosmic, not tri-unity. Here they're just trying to remind you that you have this much more immediate relationship to spirit energy there, and hence your mind is much more attuned to unity. The individuality is just there. So there's much more of an opportunity for unity and individuality to come together and have a super additive consequence there that personality can encompass. There's much more potential for the personality to be doing something there, right?
Even more so than a three-brain world.
Even more so than a three-brain world, because it's just, this spirit is still indirect for a three-brainer. Here now, the unity is so much more just directly there. That's why we can't manifest much personality here. We've got the individuality, but it's so hard to get some unity of sort of equal measure together into a super additive consequence that then personality can encompass. Right? So that's why it's so hard to do anything really genuinely personal here. It's hard to get the triunity going here. But there you can really start to get going on it.
Good news.
Okay.
If you are not to be detained on Mansion World Number 1, at the end of 10 days you will enter the translation sleep and proceed to World Number 2. And every 10 days thereafter, you will thus advance until you arrive on the world of your assignment.
So these transitions, they're not as, they'll tell you later, that, I guess it's in the next section here when they talk about the second mansion world. But these transitions from one mansion world to the next are sort of mini deaths. They aren't as definitive a death as between your nativity world and the first mansion world, it might be, several hundred thousand years before you're resurrected. Your adjuster has gone off and done all kinds of things all over the universe of universes and whatnot in between, and then finally comes back. The adjuster's not going anywhere; it's right there, but you are. They have to shut you down and build a new body for you, and everything has to get plugged in again. But it's sort of just a not too much more of a discontinuity than having to go to sleep to be transported by seraphim. But it is definitely more than being than that kind of a sleep. It's basically a death. You're unconscious completely, and they literally are taking your Maranja brain and putting it into a new body. So obviously you're shut down, you know, while they're, you know, making that transition. Let's see, anything else there? I didn't mention, they mentioned it. You notice how they use this term Mansonia, you know? See, they're just, you know, they're taking the word mansion and playing off of it, you know, using that IA suffix like they do for local system names to indicate it's like a nation-like place. Using Mansonia as sort of a substitute for saying Satania, you know, and focusing it just on the headquarters there, the world you're on, you know. But they're literally, you know, the M-A-N-S part is the same stem as you have in the word mansion. So it's just a play off of that. I mean, it basically is just saying sort of a nation that's akin to a mansion or an akin to a dwelling place is what it would mean literally. You know, M-A-S, M-A-N-S, and then the O-N, and then the I-A. Okay. But it's just, you know, they're doing that because they want you to kind of appreciate that, you know, you're on the first mansion world, and while you're there, it's sort of a universe unto itself, kind of. I mean, you know, in many, you know, even though you are trans, you know, you can take trips to Gerasim and some things like this, but in many ways, it's kind of a complete lifestyle solution, sort of, when you're there. And you know, so they're using that kind of upstepped name to indicate the sort of the completeness of that place. It's when you journey other places, it's kind of a, you can't relate as definitively to those other places. And so they're kind of, in some sense, quasi-shadowy experiences. There's nothing as intimate and tangible as just that world you're on. You got a body that's really just made for that world, see? You know, and so it's it's sort of a nation of its own. That's why they're using that coinage. Okay.
The center of the seven major circles of the First Mansion World Administration is occupied by the Temple of the Maranja Companions, the personal guides assigned to ascending mortals. These companions are the offspring of the local universe Mother Spirit, and there are several million of them on the Maranja worlds of Satania. Aside from those assigned as group companions, you will have much to do with the interpreters and translators, the building custodians, and the excursion supervisors. And all of these companions are most cooperative with those who have to do with developing your personality factors of mind and spirit within the Maranja body.
Okay, so even though they, you know, don't explain them in detail, the Maranja companions, until the next paper, they wanted to throw it in here, just a little sort of a footnote, so that you appreciate as you read through these sections about the mansion worlds that you not only have your, you know, the seraphim, you know, going along with you, but you have some companions that are more tangible, more intimate. So that, you know, what if you wake up and there really aren't any relatives or anyone that, you know, they don't, you're never allowed to be sort of alone like that. These Maranja companions are designed to be so companionable. It's as if your very best friend from your nativity world was resurrected with you. And you can pick up on a very fulfilling relationship, you know, with someone like that, someone kind of your kind, right away.
Doesn't seem like there's very many of them either.
No, there aren't.
Not really.
Right. So again, you're reminded, you know, of how one of these beings can be intimate with a pretty big group, and you won't feel like you're being ignored. Just like you can have one pair of seraphim handling 1,000, you know, or mortals or 500 mortals or whatnot. It's like, well, what if they aren't keeping eye, you know, an eye on all of them? All? No, they can keep an eye on all those just fine. So they're not as low as us. Yeah, they're able to multitask better than we are and be intimate on a broader scope than we can. But nonetheless, yes. Basically, we don't need to talk about this much. We'll talk about these a lot when we get to the next paper.
As you start out on the first mansion world, one Maharaja companion is assigned to each company of 1,000 ascending mortals. But you will encounter larger numbers as you progress through the seven mansion spheres. These beautiful and versatile beings are companionable associates and charming guides. They are free to accompany individuals or selected groups to any of the transition culture spheres, including their satellite worlds. They are the excursion guides and leisure associates of all ascending mortals. They often accompany survivor groups on periodic visits to Jerusalem. And on any day you are there, you can go to the registry sector of the system capital and meet ascending mortals from all seven of the mansion worlds, since they freely journey back and forth between their residential abodes and the system headquarters.
Okay, so that last part, remember I mentioned that we would get to that when we were reading about, you know, circles number 5, the circles of the ascending mortals back there in the previous paper. See, there it is. That's what they mean by the registry sector, that place where all those ascending mortals congregate in the circles. So you can go there, and even if you can't relate very profoundly with a being from the seventh mansion world, you get an initial experience. Try to catalyze your development on the first mansion world. And you notice how, as you get more sophisticated, your Maharaja companions can have an appropriate relationship with only with smaller and smaller groups. You know, you start out, one can handle 1,000 very intimately. But as they say, as you progress, you'll be interacting with larger numbers of them. And they're just one element. Remember, there's, you know, all kinds of other beings you're interacting with too. So it's not like, you know, they're the complete lifestyle solution for companionship. But they're the, you know, they're the specific ones that are designed just specifically for companionship. However, like they say, they said in the previous paragraph there, they're not so narrowly designed that they're no good for anything else. They synchronize very well with everything else that's going on too. Right. So.
Yeah. Well, I believe I remember that a large number of them were lost in the.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So what about them makes them vulnerable to the sophistries?
Just because they're not that much more advanced than we are.
Yeah.
Right. So. You know, when you're talking about cherubim and Maharaja companions, and, you know, like we can imagine that lesser order of angels, you know, they're not that much higher than us. They can very easily, you know, get caught up in the same sophistries that we can. Yeah. And then, of course, they don't have adjusters. It just makes it all the more problematic. Yeah, so, you know, we'll get a chance to talk about, you know, the Maharaja companions in great detail in the next paper, but you know, they just wanted to throw that in, and you know, you notice how big the first mansion world section is here. Well, they're kind of front loading it. They want to just make a couple of general statements that you can then carry forward through the rest of the sections about the other mansion worlds.
You know, yep. When we're thinking about how the guardian seraphim first have bigger groups, and then and then you get an individual pair.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But it's easy for them to watch a group, 1,000. I was just thinking in my mind about this picture of, it's real easy for them to see whether or not someone is taking the light. And you drew such a beautiful picture tonight about reaching up and taking part of this meaning and value from in the Supreme that's just there, you know, it's just so vivid that it would be easy for a guardian seraphim to see, well, there's somebody taking delight in cultivating that, and it's just beautiful. Thank you for that image.
I'm sure. Yeah. You know, and of course with the guardian seraphim, you know, remember again, you know, when you talk about them watching you, you know, they're not guarding your temporal life. They're guarding your destiny. Right, yeah. So, right. you know, in some ways, see, to be a Mirage companion, I mean, this is much more, you know, interacting with the, you know, the details of your immediate life, right? Whereas a seraphim is has a little bit more longer-term, big-picture relationship to you. All right. All right, so we'll get into the other mansion worlds next time here and go forward. And I'll say it again like I did last time. If there's any follow-up thoughts that you have, either about the probationary nursery or some of these things that we had on the that they brought forward in this first mansion world section, keep them in mind and feed it forward. We want to treat, like I said, we want to treat these. The sequence of mansion worlds as holistically as we can. So, if something we're reading makes you think about something back, that we already read about, don't be bashful. Just bring that into play again, and so we can try to synthesize what they say about these as much as possible.
Right.
All right, let's take a moment here.